Hi, and welcome to this seminar, the next in our series for the Hellenic Observatory. I'm Kevin Featherstone, and director of the Hellenic Observatory. It's a very great pleasure to welcome Sofia Vassilopoulou. And it would be impolite for me to mention that she was a former student of mine only a few years ago. So it's great to welcome Professor Vassilopoulou back. And so let me just say something about her. She is Professor of European Politics at King's College London, and she's an honorary professor at the University of York. Her research is at the intersection of comparative politics and political behavior. She studies the causes and consequences of political dissatisfaction among the public and the ways in which this is channeled through party strategies and party competition. She's published many articles in leading international journals, and she's authored a number of books, Far-Right Parties and Euroscepticism, Patterns of Opposition, The Golden Dawn's Nationalist Solution, Explaining the Rise of the Far-Right in Greece, and she's Editor-in-Chief of the European Journal of Political Science, the European Journal of Political Research, one of the top political science journals in the world. So welcome back, Sofia. As you can see, she's talking about a new project, partly collaborative, Political Trust in Greece in Comparative Perspective. We've been talking about the project, but I won't jump ahead and let Sofia explain.
Yes. Thank you very much. Well, thanks for inviting me, Kevin and Vasilis. And it's a pleasure to be here after quite a long time, actually. And thanks to everyone for coming. So I'll spend the next, say, half an hour, 45 minutes to just give you the overview of the new project I'm working on, and I will highlight the word new here. I will present some initial findings on a collaborative paper with Pablo Christman from Gesis and Pedro Magales from the University of Lisbon. But before I zoom in on the paper, I just want to talk a little bit about this kind of more general project that I'm working on at the moment, which is a special issue, a German special issue that we provisionally call the makeover of Southern Europe 50 years after Portugal, Spain and Greece's transitions to democracy. So the idea is that very soon we will have a kind of a 50-year anniversary of the transition in these three countries. And essentially what we want to do is a kind of appraisal of what has happened in the politics, policy, institutions of these three countries in the last 50 years. This sort of justifies my case selection, if you had a question on this. So we are comparing these three countries specifically because we're starting with this idea of transition to democracy. And this is why we're not working on Italy, say, or other countries. So we want to look at the conditions under which countries that share geographic, political, historical, cultural legacies might develop parallel or divergent paths. So the project hooks on democratization, but it's not a project on democratization in the sense that we are looking at different aspects of policy and polity. So we have chapters or articles on judicial politics, we have papers or chapters on the right, on one on the left. We have this work that I will be presenting to you on political trust and how it has developed over time. But we also look at policies such as attitudes to Europe, to European integration, how they have evolved over time across the three countries, or gender and so on. So this is a collaborative work with Jorge Fernandez, Nuno Garupa, and Maria Jose Hierro. And we have received an R&R from a journal. I'm not going to say which one because it's R&R. on the idea of a special issue, and this is what we're working towards. So we will be having a workshop with all the papers at some point in March. So as I said, this is very early stages, right? So, and we're hoping to publish this as a special issue. Now, of course, the focus and the zoom is on Southern Europe, but because we are all comparativists in the group that we are the co-editors, we want to be thinking about generalizable lessons about democracy that go a little bit beyond Southern Europe, just to talk about mechanisms and processes as opposed to what just happened in these three countries. So this is what the idea, this is where we're starting from. Now, this paper specifically looks at political trust in the three countries. But I suppose a starting point is to think about why focus on political trust. I should say to begin with, trust is essentially what allows to maintain stability and the legitimacy of political system. We can start from classic political scientists, let's say Easton, for instance, that talks about political trust within the context of diffuse and specific support of a political regime. And I think, why do I think that trust is important? It's because in contexts of high levels of trust in institutions, people, citizens, will help the implementation of policy even if they disagree with that policy. And I think that's very important, right? Because in every country, after elections, there are winners and losers. And we cannot always be winners. We are sometimes winners. But what happens when we lose? Do we obstruct implementation on the day-to-day kind of life of politics? Or do we help it and we trust the system in a way? We trust the institutions. I think that's very important. It's a very sort of public policy kind of way or governance kind of way of looking at the importance of trust. But beyond that, we do know that some levels of mistrust are healthy for a democracy. It is healthy for citizens to mistrust an institution so that they push them to improve. But if we're looking at distrust and widespread distrust, then there's classic literature that talks about the link of distrust and the rise of radicalism and perhaps supports for non-democratic forms of governance. Now, I guess one thing to say here is that trust, generally in the literature, is considered an evaluation. So it's an evaluative process of the individual vis-a-vis specific institutions, be it the judiciary, political parties, the government, the parliament, and so on. It's not necessarily support for democracy or not, right? And usually, what you do find in most advanced industrialized democracies is that support for the regime, as it were, stays stable, stays very high and very stable over time. So you will have, even in Greece and Spain and Portugal, where we had strong kind of crisis moments, support for democracy as a way of governance, as opposed to an authoritarian type of alternative, remained very high. However, evaluations of trust are volatile and change. And I think this is why it's interesting in a way of seeing that. Of course, there is a tipping point in some cases, and I mean, we can have a conversation about whether there was some kind of tipping point in Greece with the rise of Golden Dawn, for instance. But generally, the idea is that trust is important because it does kind of work as the glue, what Pandemir Smerli say. The glue that keeps the system together and the oil that lubricates the policy machine, and something that changes. And this is why I am personally very interested in this concept and this evaluation. Now let's have a quick look at trust across Europe. And here I'm just presenting some data from the OECD. This is not the specific data I'm working on later on, but it's very good because it's comparative across most European countries. Sorry, there was no data on Britain, but maybe for the best.
Was the survey conducted during Boris Johnson's time? Is that the explanation?
It was published in 2021.
Ah, okay.
So, yes. I just wanted to kind of present this map to you just to put the three countries in context, okay? So usually when we're thinking about trusting the European context, we think about the geographical pattern. Trust tends to be fairly high in Scandinavian Nordic countries. So here, of course, we see Sweden, Finland, very high levels of trust. Germany, so the blue, so the deeper the blue, the higher the levels of trust. The paler the color, the lower, the aggregate levels of trust. And this is recent data, just in 2021. And I should remind you, this is trust in government. Specifically. So the geographical pattern is that Scandinavia, and in this case Germany and Ireland, they enjoy fairly healthy, as it were, levels of trust, although I want to return to the point of what is a healthy level of trust. And then we have the Eastern Bloc, which is on the other side, as in the least, trust in institutions. So we have Poland, the Czech Republic, and so on. And then you see that Greece and Spain and Portugal actually vary. So Greece and Spain are sort of in the middle, and they're fairly similar to each other. But Portugal is following the Nordic or the Scandinavian model, as it were. So already, yes.
I don't know if we have questions.
I'm happy for that. I don't mind.
Only if there's something. Go ahead.
It's a related question.
Yes.
So maybe you introduced it as an issue of trust on institutions. But here it's like confidence in government. And of course, confidence in government must correlate, hopefully, with competence of the government. So, you know.
So what correlates with what?
With the quality of the government. So when you have. Yes. Least trust, and you ask somebody if they have confidence in the government, you know, if they said, no, I don't have confidence, it wouldn't mean that they don't trust the institutions. It's probably anything else than that they don't trust the institutions. So can you tell us a bit about, like, you know, how you or the literature moves across different worlds that could mean similar things, like confidence and trust is not necessarily the same.
You mean as the
because
the concept
the
confidence in the national
term.
Yes, yes. The difference of conceptual definitions.
Well, I mean, also
I think in the literature, I understand correctly, you are asking if we ask individuals how confident you are in the government versus how much trust you have in the government. So there's the use of term that you're saying.
Yeah.
Well, in the literature, they are generally considered as a very similar thing. And generally, off the top of my mind, Eurobarometer uses the word trust, whereas the World Value Survey uses the word confidence. What you will see, a lot of papers might match the data and use them as similar kind of questions. On a second point that I think you probably made is that this will correlate with quality of governance. Did you say that?
Not in the broad sense, but I mean, how much confidence do I have in the government? It depends a bit on how able the government is to deliver on a specific case.
Absolutely, I will come to that.
Isn't there some aspect, though, that the sentence continues? So I'm trying to remember in the sense that it's not simply confidence in the national government. Isn't it confidence in the national government to do something?
No, it is how much confidence or trust, depending on who asks the question, you have in your country's government. And then the second question would be in your country's parliament, in the Greek parliament, in the Greek government.
Okay.
And here the question is about the institution, right, rather than the government at the time. Of course, people might read it differently, absolutely, and that's why later I'm going to show quite a few different indicators. The point of this map was to show, basically, that Spain and Greece are sort of in the middle, comparatively speaking, across Europe, whereas Portugal is displaying Nordic kind of levels of trust in 2021. Yeah.
Sophia, if I may, we know that when we speak of trust in the European South, and we talk about interpersonal trust, we know that the European South and Greece in particular are very low. They score very low on that. I'm wondering whether what you're measuring here is to some extent contextual or circumstantial on the basis that, you know, I see a lot of PR systems here. There is an expectation that, like you said, that it comes from satisfaction with the fact that your party won, you have broad coalitions that operate. On the other hand, we have fragmentation in Spain, Italy, and Greece, not in Portugal. So essentially, are we just depicting the post-crisis issue of party fragmentation in the European South with this particular one? And of course, if there is a picture from 2000 or 2004, when in Greece we had governments of 42%, right, probably there, the picture would be very similar to the north. Is there a chance that we have data?
I have data. We saw data from the Eurobarometer survey in the three countries over time from 97 to 2021.
And it fluctuates.
It fluctuates, yeah, and that was the actual point of this. But I think you're absolutely right. There are many variables to consider, and I will mention some in a moment. Yes, it's a snapshot. You will see, and I will show in a minute, that trust in Greece and Spain actually was quite high before the crisis, in comparative perspective. It fluctuated a lot, it dropped a lot, it has remained low, whereas here it has recovered. Okay, so let me just go into that. Because, for example, proportionality and so on, yes, they are classic sort of theories in this literature,
yeah.
Right? Yeah. And this is the answer to your question. Okay, so let me just repeat. The point of the previous map was really to just kind of get where the three countries that we're interested in kind of sit. And of course, in comparative perspective. And of course, this is a presentation for, you know, in the context of the Hellenic Observatory. So I want to talk about Greece a little bit more compared to the other countries, but obviously they will feature. So what do we have here? We have trust in four different institutions, government, parliament, parties, and the judiciary over time in Greece. These are aggregated per Eurobarometer survey wave. We have quite a lot of waves. I can't remember off the top of my hand. The only thing to say in here, this flat line, we don't have data here, just for this judiciary, but that's all. So what we see here, because in a way, and I think this already kind of speaks to some of the comments that you made, is that it's potentially preferable or more interesting to look at evolution of trust within a country over time, as opposed to necessarily comparing it to other countries. Or at least it kind of gives us a bit more nuanced picture. So let's look at here. We are starting at kind of end of 90s. Trust in judiciary is quite high in Greece. And I think in terms of parliament and government, you would say it's a fairly healthy kind of levels compared to what we have now. We are about 0.5 with quite a bit of fluctuation. Whereas trust in political parties is already quite low. So let's start with the judiciary. What we see is we start quite high, and I mean, you can debate, everything fluctuates, right? But you could think that actually the drop is around here, which is, let's say, around 2008. And I don't want to put a specific date that it happened on January 2008, but around that time, right? Which obviously, In the Greek case, coincides with essentially kind of elections before 2009, Papandreou coming into power and so on. Interestingly, political parties, trust is very low, also starts dropping here, and then it stays very, very, very low. Right? We're talking about 0.1, right? About 10% of Greeks trust political parties. Perhaps the most interesting picture, in a way, is what happens with trust in parliament and government, which essentially drops quite substantively around 2008. There is a little bit of fluctuation and then keeps dropping until about 2015. We are here. Sorry, maybe it's better. Here we have the election of 2015, right? The Syriza and Anel coalition coming to power, or the election around that. Then again a drop, and here we have a rise. This is 2019 election. So there is quite a lot of fluctuation. What we see is that, for example, trust in the judiciary has recovered to more or less pre-crisis levels. The other three indicators haven't. Okay? And now I have a graph comparing Greece. This is Greece compared to Spain. So on the left-hand side, is Greece is the same graph as before, and I just have Spain on the right. Now, what we see here, for example, trust in the judiciary was much lower in Spain before the crisis compared to Greece. And it dropped quite a lot, and it has more or less recovered. So in a way, already we see that trust in the judiciary is a little bit more resilient in a way. Now, trust in political parties, again, started quite low in Spain, dropped substantively, and remained quite low. Very similar picture. Now, in terms of government and parliament, again, I think that you could say that, broadly speaking, around 2008, with the crisis, we see the drop. And around 2015, we see the beginning of kind of recovery. But still, the levels have not recovered to pre-crisis levels as well, the levels of trust in government and in parliament. So, broadly speaking, I think Greece and Spain can be categorized fairly similar in terms of the trends. Let's look at Portugal. Okay, so Portugal, again, on the left is Greece, is the same graph as before. Portugal is the new graph on the right. So here, what do we see? Again, we see trust in the judiciary, government and parliament at between 0.5, 0.6 before the crisis. Again, fluctuation, but the drop happens a little bit later, around 2010. And as I will show later, I think the crisis was not, the economic side of the crisis was not as protracted there. Then what we see is that trust in political parties remains low, but doesn't fluctuate as much as in Greece or Spain equally. And then if you go here, we see around 2015, similar kind of time towards the end of the crisis, everything starts picking up. But here we see that government and parliament is recovered to pre-crisis levels.
Just a quick point. Impressionistically, there seems to be some similarity between Portugal and Spain, by contrast to Greece, in the sense that for Greece, it's trust in the judiciary, which is always the first ranked, whereas Spain and Portugal, parliament
is much more. Yes.
It fluctuates much more.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. And in a way, I mean, I had a long conversation with my co-authors about that, because, you know, we have too many variables here, too many things. But in a way, judiciary is the most is interesting in a way, because it's, why is it that in one country there is more resilience in judiciary compared to parties or parliaments and so on, as opposed to others? So it's a puzzle in itself.
Mm.
And perhaps when we sit down to write this as a kind of, you know, to choose what we're going to put in this paper, you know, you could even have an angle just having a paper on the judiciary, because it's a puzzle in itself. And the purpose of my presentation today is to give you a bit of a rich picture and probably pose more questions than answers in a way and have this conversation. But yeah, I fully agree. Because the gap here is quite bigger.
Yeah.
So can I say something? So of course these are point estimates, if you want. Yeah. So if you want to talk about the
you know, when you saw Greece in, let's say, 2018, and you say the judiciary has more support than the, what is it, than the party system, the political parties, I can see whatever that is, 50% of points gap, and I believe you, that must be statistically significant. But when you look, go and say that, sometimes in Portugal, after 2015, sometimes the parliament overtakes the judiciary, that may not be, you know, if you think of it in terms of statistical significance, looks very unlikely that it would be statistically.
I'm only looking at it descriptively here, because these are aggregates per Eurobarometer wave. That's all.
I'm just saying, in the sense that, so, you know, like the conclusion that the judiciary is not always on top. Well, okay, different than in Greece, but not really with some accuracy. That
here it's quite close, right?
No, I mean, after 2010, let's say, that the convergence in Portugal may be more evident, but then maybe if you look at 2020 in Greece, statistically the two lines may not be different, even if they look to be quite apart.
Obviously I am speculating now, right? Because it's quite obvious, isn't it?
Let's move on, because we're going to have problems with time.
Okay, key observations so far, least fluctuation when it comes to the judiciary, which tends to be comparatively high, so we see the least fluctuation. We also see the least fluctuation when it comes to trust in political parties, which is also comparatively low across. I think we see most fluctuation when it comes to trust in government and trust in parliament. More or less, and I say I don't want to put a date as in a specific year, I can talk about 1 or 2 years around this. I think we do see critical moments around the onset of the crisis and towards the end of the crisis, trust is trying to pick up. Now, as we see, there is a continuous upward trend in Portugal. We don't see the similar kind of trends or more fluctuation in Greece and Spain. And in a way, we're interested in, you know, what might make public trust resilient or more volatile, as it were. Now, in terms of the theory, and I think that goes back to points you've made earlier. So how does the literature sees this? There are quite a few theories, but I think they can broadly be grouped under output type of theories. So what's to do with the output of government performance or general performance of the state, and input that I will talk a little bit in a moment. So when it comes to output or output legitimacy, one can talk about that. We can put economic performance under that and quality of governance. So, and I have a quote here from Easton, which I think is quite interesting. Evaluations of outputs and performance may help to generate and probably at all times help to sustain confidence in the authorities, right? It comes even from that. And I keep mentioning Easton because he's one of the classics in the literature here. So economic performance, I think the argument is very, very simple. If we have declining levels of economic performance, people have less disposable income, they tend to feel much more insecure, trust tends to decline. Okay? When it comes to quality of governance, we speak about or we refer to the impartiality of decision-making process. You could put a number of indicators under this. The most highly cited and highly used indicators is basically institutional corruption, because it affects outputs, right? For example, if you have low levels of public service provisions, you will see decline in the levels of trust. So these are kind of more the output legitimacy of the system kind of theories. When it comes to the input legitimacy of the system, such as political performance, you could group these arguments under two, let's say, broad umbrellas. One has to do with the evaluations of government performance and generally government responsiveness. So is the government And again, the government as an institution responding to people's needs and so on. So how close is it? Close is the government to citizens' preferences? And of course, that might depend on, again, if you're a loser or a winner, it might depend on the distribution of the citizens in the country. Do you have people who are kind of more close to center? Do you have people who are more extremist? It has to do, obviously, with the government, right? Is it closer to that? Or is it a more of extremist government and so on? So usually, when you see that on average people are close to the government's preferences, there is going to be more trust in the institution. And the second point is what Spiros mentioned about consensus models of democracy and electoral competition. Basically, the core idea here is that if you are operating in PR systems, they prioritize representation in a way. So even if you lose, if you are an electoral loser and you might be dissatisfied because you are an electoral loser, you are more committed to the system because you know, at least you know, your concerns might be voiced by smaller parties, newer parties. There's more probability for newer parties to emerge. In a way, the system gives you much more choice, as it were. And that generally tends to be associated with higher levels of trust. So we've taken these kind of three theories, as it were, and we're trying to test them, or to, I wouldn't say test them, I think test them is a bit of a strong word, because we're at very early stages of this project. What we're trying is to see descriptively how they move. So everything without, I'll give you some more information in a moment, but everything we've done is on an aggregate level at this stage. Now, of course, we have these three theories, and we only have three countries now. So, it's not that we are testing these three theories against 184 countries in the world over, 50 points in time and so on. So we are already kind of a bit more constrained in terms of what we can do. But we know if we look at these three countries from a kind of classic comparative method point of view, they are quite similar, certainly in terms of the fact that they are all sort of started democratizing in a similar point in time. So culturally speaking, so they all three have a right-wing authoritarian past. Geography is similar, kind of levels of development before EU accession were kind of similar. EU accession kind of helped them to modernize in a similar way. They all received, or they were good contenders for cohesion funds at the beginning, obviously in the 80s and the 90s, and so on. So this is kind of a similar, let's say, cultural context, as it were. They were very hard hit by the economic downturn and the crisis. They all received external financial assistance. There was austerity, cuts, and so on. Although we are going to test it, we're going to look at how this worked. And I don't think, if you zoom in on the three countries, it was not identical, I think, the crisis. It has parallels, but it was not exactly the same. And I think in all three countries, this economic crisis was associated with a type of political crisis. There was collapse of governments, there was multiple elections, rise of populism, perhaps more in Spain than Portugal and so on. So this is kind of our context, and I've got a few graphs, actually. Before I go into the graphs, I'm just going to tell you very briefly what data we're using. Again, this is aggregate level stuff that we're doing at the moment. No regressions, only figures, right? The trust data that I showed you are from Eurobarometer. So there are questions about trust in the parliament, in the government, parties and judiciary. I should say that the question has a binary answer. It's only I trust or I don't trust. So it's not on a scale, it's not on a continuum. So of course it gives you a bit more of a crude image of what's happening.
You mean that in the Eurobarometer it's binary, or that you have converted it into a binary?
It's a binary.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So So what we're trying to do is test it. The three theories that we, or not test again, so we are rephrasing that. These three theories provide good contenders that we should look in a bit more depth, let's say. So in terms of the economic output argument, we have constructed the economic performance index, which is basically a nice way of putting together, it comes from the IMF, putting together four indicators: unemployment, deficit, inflation, and GDP growth. So instead of having to look at each sort of indicator differently and then produce a million graphs, this gives you a nice sort of line of what happened. So that's how we look at the economy. In terms of corruption, we are looking at, we are using the Transparency International Corruption Perceptions Index, and here I'll show you in a minute. But basically, smaller values means more corrupt; higher values means less corrupt. Now, in terms of the left-right position of the government, because we talked about how the people are, whether they are close to the government or not, we use the PowerGov data. Who actually, its government, you know, has a value basically. And for the point about proportionality, we looked at the effective number of parties, which is a classic indicator by Laxco and Tagliapena. We'll come back to these things because, you know, you might forget a few things. So let's just try to see what's going on here. So the figure on the left is again trust in institutions in Greece. We've seen that a lot of times, but I wanted to put it next to the performance figure so we can sort of see the parallels. So, and the lines that I've drawn here, just to remind you, the first one is around 2008, where we have the onset of the crisis. The second is around 2015, coincides with Syriza. And the third one is around 2019, coincides with New Democracy. And on the right, you have, there is a figure that combines the indicator of the economic performance index, which is the dashed line. And what we see here is how Greece was before the crisis, and how around 2008, again, here, coinciding with the drop of trust, actually the economic performance index also dropped. Now, I think what the interesting thing about the economy is that around 2019, it comes up, right? It sort of recovers to momentarily, not for too long, to pre-crisis levels. Yet, as we saw, trust, especially when it comes to, you know, the three indicators at the bottom, did not recover to pre-crisis levels. Now, of course, here, as a side note, here it drops, this is COVID, right? And obviously, the story is kind of changes afterwards, and we have not that much data since. But in a way, I think the story here, or perhaps the story here, is that, yes, there is this idea that economic performance matters for trust. You know, the country is not doing well. People are comparing to previous years, for instance. They see the change. They tend to attribute this lack of you know, high levels of economic performance to institutions, and then they lose their trust, right? They become frustrated, as it were. In a way, you can make an argument here. It's possibly quite persuasive. However, the interesting thing is that when the economy recovers, trust doesn't always recover, which tells you something about the asymmetrical effects of the economy in a way, right? It's much more easy to lose trust than to regain trust. Now, when it comes to corruption, it's this line here. So what we see is that, just to remind you, the lower the values, the more corruption, yeah? And if you excuse me, I have the ranking of Greece here somewhere, and I wanted to... I wanted to give you the ranking. So think about it. Greece, in 2010, around here, this is where there was a great drop. ranked together with at rank number 80, together with Peru, Thailand, Morocco, and Colombia. And then in 2021, it picks up to its pre-crisis levels, and it's, it ranks 58, so it's a bit better in comparison, together with Armenia, Jordan, and Namibia.
Sophia, these are so the, this is the Transparency International.
Yes.
Yeah.
So this is a survey as well. So the
it's a perceptions thing.
So it's okay. Yeah.
Let's make progress because I'm slightly conscious about the time.
It is a survey. It gives you aggregate. You just transplant whatever they give you, and you here I put the this is the score, but I just read out the ranking. Now I think the interesting thing, in my opinion, here is that basically corruption. We see a drop in trust before corruption scandals. So I don't think it's a clear cut sort of story to be said. And then again, corruption goes back to pre-crisis levels, which are still low, but they're pre-crisis levels, as it were. But again, trust does not go back to that. We've done the same thing for Spain. I think in terms of the economy, the story is similar in the sense that the EPI, again, this is the last line, drops at around 2008, sort of similar time as with trust. Again, it recovers, not as much, but it kind of seems to recover. It does not seem that trust recovers in the same way. And interestingly, and actually I was reading a few papers about corruption. There were corruption scandals, and what we saw is that despite the fact that the economy did better in Spain, actually there were quite a lot of corruption scandals towards the end of the decade. And it's possible that trust is sort of or low levels of trust is reflecting that, that pattern. Similar graph for Portugal. One thing to say here is that the EPA index shows that the crisis was not as protracted in Portugal in comparison to the other two countries. Again, in comparison, of course there is a drop, and of course there was an issue. And even if you decompose the index, because it includes unemployment, unemployment at the height of the crisis in Greece and Spain was double than Portugal. So which shows here in this graph. But okay, we can say that certainly there was something here in the drop of trust and drop of economic performance. Again, it has picked up. Here it has picked up and trust has picked up. Right? So it's not a clear picture in the sense that you cannot say there is a linear relationship that works in all countries in the same kind of way. And corruption, yes?
I just wanted to ask whether the kind, let's say, of crisis could matter for the movement also of the corruption perception, because like at first glance, basically every country dips or drops considerably in the corruption perception index after 2008 crisis, but it's not the same for COVID or 2001 crisis, for instance. So maybe the handling of the crisis or the fact that 2008 was, for instance, the financial crisis, whereas 2020, 2021, not the same. But,
yeah, I think that's a very good point, very important. And in a way, thinking about the Greek context, there was a big debate about, you know, when the Eurozone crisis erupted, there was a big debate whether the Greek issue had to do with external issues, right? What was happening in the world, but also what was happening in Greece 20 years before the crisis, and to what extent parts of the political system, parties and so on, were responsible for aspects of the crisis, right? Whereas with COVID, it's a different kind of story. I agree there. I mean, in the moment in time that we don't have data, but I think this is a very interesting thing we'll see over time, right? And what kind of scandal, corruption scandal, will affect trust? You know, we're talking about the current scandal with Mitsotakis. Has that affected trust? People seem to be quite supportive of the government if there was an election next year. So I agree, right, where was I? Sorry. Okay. So, and the last point I wanted to make here was about corruption. Corruption is pretty flat. I don't think there has been that much fluctuation. I don't think we can say much about corruption in Portuguese context. Now, bear with me. Three more graphs.
Three more graphs and that's it? Perfect.
I have been interrupted, Pietro. So it has been a conversation.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, so what I wanted to do now is to show some information on the political sort of argument that we said before. And here on the left, this is Greece. And what I am showing is the darker line is the electorate position of citizens, again, aggregated by Eurobarometer survey. And the dashed line here is the position of the government. And because I thought it was too much to remember, I have actually written what is when, because it's quite a lot of governments, quite a few countries, and so on. Now, the interesting thing is, I mean, to cut a long story short, I don't think, at least on aggregate, yet we can say that much about the political arguments on aggregate. It might work differently at the individual level. But interestingly, public opinion is around the middle in Greece and has not changed over time, and it's the same pattern in the other two countries. So they're slightly right of center. This is left, right, this is left, this is right. Interestingly, PASOK governments have always been closer to the average people. New Democracy is here, there is a gap. I don't see Syriza and Anel, there is a gap, and so on. Again, if you think about 2008, 2009, actually there is quite close, so that doesn't tell us anything, I think, at least in this example. And then 2015, that we saw before, trust picks up, and we have the Syriza annual government. Actually, the gap is much bigger. Again, on average, right? Because of course, for different individuals, things can be interpreted in different ways. On the right-hand side, we have just the effective number of electoral parties and parliamentary parties over time, just to kind of see how that kind of speaks in this case. And obviously, it's clear that actually parties become more and more, they increase in number after the crisis. So, and of course, there is a question of endogeneity here, right? Mm-hmm. What is the cause, what is the effect? Spain, again, similar picture in the sense that public opinion is around the center, on average. PSOE, or left-wing governments, tend to be closer to people. Again, we have the crisis around here, and this government actually seems to have we have the crisis around here when there was congruence. So the crisis meaning dropping trust. And up here, we have around 2015, trust levels start to improve, and actually there is no congruence, right? So again, at this level, you can't say that much.
Sophia, can I, because of the measurement.
Yeah.
Can we finish this at the end anyway? So just
okay. Yeah. Okay. But I'd like us to get to the big picture rather than.
But you see congruence here. But the position of the parties is something that is. Done not on a measure. It's
a measure. It's the position of the party. It's the position of the government. It's done on a measure by the PALGAP data, who aggregate the government and they weigh per electoral percentage for the gap. So they give you a score government.
The Socialist Party in Spain and PASOK in the 90s were done on the center of the political spectrum.
According to this data set. Whereas, for example, Syriza earlier, it's around 3.9 or what have you here, right? Yeah.
Is it policies or manifesto commitments?
It's the PALGAP data. So it's not policy or manifesto commitments. It's basically, I think they say experts.
Expert assessments.
Okay, let's go to the big picture, actually, okay? And again, with Portugal, you can say something here, perhaps. that around 2010, where we had the drop of trust, there is a bit of a gap here. Again, I wouldn't say much. In terms of the effective number of parties, it's actually quite flat. Let's go to the big picture, because this is what kind of Kevin wants us to focus, and I think that's fair enough. I had a few graphs, but you have to forgive me. There is a lot of variables, a lot of variation, three countries and so on. So, key findings. One thing that I would like to focus on as a point is that the economy has asymmetric effects. I think it's very hard to argue that the economic performance doesn't matter. Okay? However, drop in economic performance tends to correlate with it, or tell us what happens hand in hand with dropping in trust, but recovery doesn't. And I think that in itself kind of poses an interesting question, right? And even if the economy recovers, are the levels of the standard of living, is the standard of living similar to what happened before, or kind of more broadly, how easy it is to recover trust, right? With corruption, I'd say that the data at this level show that perhaps that might be a potentially relevant variable for Spain in the sense of over time. The political argument, I would say that's, I wouldn't say there is a clear pattern, perhaps something to say about Portugal. And I think that within the context of three countries, it's quite endogenous, right? Because it's clear that in those three countries, which were very small party systems, two, three, four parties, actually we saw that political parties, the number of parties increased after the crisis. So it's a bit of an endogenous kind of thing to say. That said, it's worth looking at. The next thing we will be doing is to look at everything at the individual level. Unfortunately, because we are prioritizing overtime trends, we have less variables. So we have sociodemographics, but we don't have, for example, perceptions of the economy or perceptions of corruption and so on. So we have to stick with what we've got. And one idea that we were thinking of pursuing is to look at whether the decline of trust is asymmetrical across different socioeconomic groups. So, for example, could it be, because we know in the literature that education is, highly educated people tend to be more trusting of the system. Could it be that during the crisis, it was the highly educated that lost their trust and that the low educated remain at lower levels? Again, it's something to check, and I think this is potentially where we're going. I talked about the limitations, and the last point I want to say before I finish is the benchmark, right? What are good levels of trust, and how do people as a heuristic actually evaluate what is a good level for them or not? So, you know, maybe we have recovered to about 0.4 or 0.35. Is that too bad in the end, right? And I guess I want to leave that up for discussion. So thank you very much.
Okay, thanks very much. Okay, yes, so we do have plenty of time for this one. but I wanted to get to the big picture, because I see better here. The essential question is the resilience of systems. That's what you posed at the beginning. What makes for resilience of trust? And you have the three cases, but as your penultimate slide showed, it seems to me that we have almost three separate stories. So trying to put it together in terms of what is the big picture, it's not obvious that there is one narrative which covers the three cases. But I wonder, to go beyond that, whether your point here about perceptions may actually be the a stronger way forward. That is, that I noticed before when you were talking about the economic performance index, for example, I'd have thought that what might be more telling is a sense of the lived experience of the economy. So, for example, including government deficit, it's not immediately obvious that a voter would respond to trends in the government deficit level of the government wants to spend more money for it. Great. Inflation, unemployment, much more telling or measures of the standard of living. But also, perhaps, more consequentially, the point about your grasp and perceptions of corruption. You have, I think, different trends across your three cases, where perceptions of corruption seem to be having a different relationship with the intensity of the economic crisis across the three cases. In the Grigg case, I'd have thought that, again, it's something there about the perceptions of, you have perceptions of my living standards, perceptions of corruption. It's something there which is a subjective evaluation. When it comes to corruption, what was the Grigg case? What was the Grigg narrative? 2010, the world is saying that you should be thinking this about corruption in Greece. There was almost an external imposition of a narrative about corruption in Greece. So, from the measures that you have, I struggle to think, what is it telling us across the three cases about resilience of trust? However, if one progressed beyond that and talked about perceptions of the more subjective evaluation, I wonder that might actually be a more meaningful measure anyway. Precisely because things like your economic performance index might seem a little abstract in some ways. That it's, I noticed that you kept referring to the beginning of the economic crisis, the beginning of 2008. I thought that most voters in Southern Europe wouldn't really have felt a crisis until the beginning of 2010.
Okay, there's quite a few points to say there. I mean, the very short, well, first of all, the point about perceptions versus objective evaluations of the economy. The very short answer to this question is there's no data. The more, most importantly, there is a very big debate in the literature on this. And there are advantages and disadvantages for on both approaches. In my case, it's just impossible to do it because there's no data. But in terms of what we know from the literature is that objective criteria are better because they're essentially exogenous to trust. They actually happen,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Whereas perceptions can be very endogenous. So you are explaining,
yes,
one attitude with another attitude. So there is that advantage of objective criteria as opposed to perceptions. That being said, a careful reading of the literature across time and across countries actually shows that objective indicators vary in terms of their effect. So there is no clear picture. And it's possible, exactly because, as you were saying, people might not necessarily feel it, or they might feel it, there might be a time lag, they might feel it in their pocketbook 2 years later, for instance. So I guess a core objective variable or indicator that tends to work most of the time is unemployment. Because unemployment, as opposed to growth or deficit and so on, is something that people feel much more in their daily life. And if they're not unemployed themselves, it's the risk of unemployment, what they see in their community and so on. So there are arguments in favor of objective criteria, but equally I see your point. If there was more wealth of data, what I would do is actually combine the two and see which one is most important. But clearly, some literature will tell you that you shouldn't really be trying to explain an attitude with a perception, because how do you know what's, is a chicken and egg, can become a chicken and egg issue.
Okay, yeah,
thanks, Sophia. I have a few questions. Let me start with So one of the things that you could do, like in economics, we call it misery index, unemployment times inflation. So you know, these are the most visible things for the individual. Kevin's right, you know, you pay attention to your government debt, but at a very different level, one, inflation and unemployment. Let me ask this as a first point. I really don't understand why, if you want to look at the kind of the big question, you know, kind of the resilience of institutions or trust in institutions, then why you restrict the sample to the three countries? You can easily do, 20 years or whatever, 20 waves of your barometer or whatever it is, times the 24 whatever countries it covers. So you have a panel, 400 observations, you can throw in 20 variables, start selecting. So for example, you can put your EPI, it doesn't work, I'll put my misery index, it doesn't work, I will put inflation, change unemployment, and then I will, you know, pin down, okay, change unemployment actually matters, EPI does matter. Then I would go, you know, the Transparency International Index versus the, who does the Gothenburg Quality of Government? You know, and play with it. Because with the graphs, of course, you can on three countries, because obviously you cannot have a graph of 38 countries, you would lose it there. But, you know, you can, it's very easy to tell a story by, it increased here or it declined there, and then, you know, tell a story. I mean, I come from economics here, so I would say that, but, you know, statistics will come and tell you, at the 7% level, this is accurate, or it's not accurate. In a much more kind of convincing, assertive language. So I really don't understand I thought the big picture question would be much more specific to the case. Whereas I don't understand why you got to the big question of, you know, resilience of institutions at the general level, rather than in Portugal, Spain and Greece, if I understood correctly.
Sorry, just to add the sentence, you could then compare. Clearly, the three cases have been selected because it's Southern Europe post-authoritarian regimes.
Yeah.
You could then compare it, as you say, as a pool of countries to the larger number.
I mean, in the
what is different
the
about
slow post-term. Dummy and fine? You know,
yes.
So what I mean is that I thought we would be looking at much more contextual factors rather than the, you know, the, so Transparency International, you know, they asked 20 people, do you think the Greece is corrupt? Yeah, it was in the news yesterday that it was corrupt, so I will say it was corrupt. You know, like, you know how these things happen, and many of us have participated in this service, you know.
But the original peg was to choose three countries which are post-authoritarian. So in your point, you could look at, is there something distinctive about post-authoritarian systems as opposed to the rest of the OECD?
Yeah, then you would need to compare it with non-authoritarian.
The rest of the OECD.
I should say I fully agree with everything. This is the first iteration. We literally just finished the data set. It was not, the majority of the work will happen at the individual level rather than at the aggregate. I thought this would be nice to provide a broader picture. As I said, I came more with questions and trying to see the kind of big picture as opposed to having answers. The selection of the cases has to do with the special issue. So in a way, we are constrained. We could, what you say, that would be a different paper, as it were. Perhaps perhaps asking the question in such a broad way raises expectations, and perhaps we need to make it a bit more specific. That being said, because currently this is due to go to a comparative politics journal, we need to also open up. So we are kind of, it's a fine balance, as it were, in terms of, okay, we're only working on the three cases, but actually we want to say something a bit broader. So hence, I'm just justifying where I'm coming from. I think what we will be doing soon enough is actually testing all this at the individual. Of course, we don't have that many time points, so we cannot have that many variables. What you will find is that corruption doesn't really matter. And generally, corruption is a difficult one. Corruption doesn't vary as much. People in one country might think, okay, this country is corrupt. It might vary from, you know, ranking 60 to ranking 65, but it does, substantively, it doesn't really.
It's a cultural thing.
it can be a cultural thing, and it's also after a big scandal erupts, and then there's another scandal. Even if there's no scandal, people might be biased by prior experience. So it's a difficult one, but we wanted to look at this and examine this variable because it's a core variable in the literature, even if ultimately, it probably in our case, it doesn't really make much difference. I think what we're trying to do, or what we're hoping to do, is, as I said, to look at it at the individual level and look at sociodemographics and how they change. I think this is where we're probably going to go to. Because there's so much you can do with the data. I should say we have chosen Transparency International because they have the longest time frame, because time frame for us is important, because we're doing the, it speaks to the special issue. Quality of governance and World Bank indicators and all that, they have a much smaller time frame. And actually we had the satisfaction with democracy variable here, which in the Eurobarometer goes further back in time. But Transparency International doesn't go us back, so we had to choose basically these choices to be made. So, yeah, I mean, that's a very long way of saying I agree, but that, just to kind of give you a bit of context of why we did what we did in this specific project so far, and that is work in progress, and obviously we'll take that into consideration.
So, just before coming, that if the case selection is post-authoritarian regimes, wouldn't the thing be to focus on satisfaction with democracy?
Satisfaction? Well, you are opening a big debate here. Satisfaction with democracy is satisfaction with how democracy works.
Mm.
That's not about whether you are happy with the regime, as in democracy versus non-democracy or other types of government. It's about how democracy works. So in the literature, question is about essentially outputs of democracy.
Okay.
So in that sense, it's not identical, but similar to trust. It's not satisfaction with, support for the regime, e.g. am I in favor of democracy or do I prefer an authoritarian regime?
Okay,
yeah.
Sorry. Please.
Thank you, Oscar, very much for the presentation. I have two points. One on the limitation right there. So, of course, when it comes to perceptions of economic performance, corruption, etc., one thing that has been lately being done increasingly is research on social media. So, how, for example, using big data to access on a micro level also the perception, in this case, of economic performance, specific groups. Of course, that in itself has the limitation, it will not go as back in time as you would like it to be because it's a recent phenomenon, but it could potentially help you tackle the latest two circles in the graph of Greece, for example, the one that followed Syriza and the latest New Democracy government. So definitely this could be something that you could look into because it would also allow to do some research on a micro level and include the education age of the participants as well. So definitely, I think that if that would be of interest to you, including social media information, could definitely be a way to kind of quantify them in a better way. One of the comments that Professor Mastriot mentioned earlier about how do they rank the different parties in different countries, and there have been measurements. Based on the tweets, for example, specific politicians or specific people in the society to understand where does the society and the politicians stand, for example. And this is on the micro level, just an idea I had in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And on a more macro level, I was wondering whether you think always in the idea of trust and with solidarity in the war in Ukraine, so would you think that trusting governments, confidence in government matters more, or more the trust on the European institutions and confidence on a European level for the war in Ukraine?
Yes. So,
that's fine.
In terms of the social media point, I think it's important. I mean, here we prioritize trends over time. So social media don't go back. And anecdotally, all political scientists and social scientists are worrying about what's going to happen now that Elon Musk bought Twitter and what kind of social media are they going to be analyzing. On the second question, I don't know whether... I genuinely don't know whether support for Russia has to do with trust in the EU or in the government or so on. But what you can say is that the sort of pro-Putin sort of ideas tend to, at least we know in the literature, to be intermixed with conspiracy theories, which also tend to be intermixed with more far-right ideas. Greece is a peculiar case in that sense because conspiracies can also be left-wing in this country. So I don't think there is a kind of clear-cut answer to this, but I think there's groups of ideas that would go under, you know, far-right, conspiracy, pro-Putin, which is an interesting one because some people could be anti-establishment in terms of anti-Western elites, but they are pro-non-Western elites, which is probably something different, yeah.
Okay.
Can I go
back?
Kira,
you Kira, go first.
No, it's no. Okay, fine. It's a quick one anyway, so thanks a lot for a stimulating discussion. I don't know if it fits very well with the literature and your approach, etc., but I was wondering if there's anything to be said about the political strategies that the parties followed in the three countries and the ferocity of public dialogue. Mm-hmm. So maybe, you know, when you start in the context of three similar post-authoritarian countries with similar ideologies, similar anti-right, you know, impulse in the population, what kind of then drives divergence in the type of political landscape that you have could also be, you know, to what extent we decide, or as a party, as a politician, to call our enemies, you know, anti-democratic or terrible people, or I don't know, even pedophiles or something, and whether kind of the political supply side can somehow come to the picture in this specific comparison.
Yes, I think that's an excellent point. We've discussed that probably not enough. Ideally, you need to have a measure of polarization over time, right? So, if you only see, I think it does come into the equation, and the argument in Portugal is, at least based on my co-author, is that when the economic recovery started happening in Portugal, people tend to be very happy and supportive of the socialist minority government that came in. And in a way, somehow they provided a closure. There was not a lot going on. Whereas in Spain and in Greece, it seems that the debate continued. Perhaps, you know, in Spain, there is Podemos that came into power, the Syriza coalition, so it was a bit more polarization. So it could be actually that there is something to this, and we'll look into that. I think that's very helpful.
That's it. And then Spanish.
I would like to go back to the point about sort of, you know, whether it would make sense to go a bit more in depth from the contextual explanation of the three cases, but try to look at the general variables. Because you said, like, you know, the moment of the crisis was similar. And then you alluded to the fact that, well, actually, in fact, crises were not that similar, and they were not. So, similarity between Greece and Spain, they moved from 8% unemployment to 36-37% unemployment.
Yeah, and more, and youth unemployment even.
Yeah, youth unemployment, yes. Portugal, out of the top of my head, I don't remember, but something like from 5-9% unemployment. Yeah, so, no comparable.
I think at some point they were about 18%.
Were they?
Yeah.
Full unemployment, not youth unemployment. Anyway, maybe they were, okay. Also,
but still, it was not as high as the other.
Yeah, in Greece it was a public debt thing, government collapsed, you know, we know all the story. In Portugal, as far as I know, they appointed they brought in the technocrats, university professors from abroad and stuff, and built a government that actually implemented, signed a memorandum, they implemented some memorandum, they got out of the memorandum, no blood or anything, you know. So, of course, then the reconciliation when the socialist government came to power was very easy to happen because it was you know, like also in Latvia, they had a 25% loss of GDP in 1 year, and then a 20% increase in GDP the next year. Yeah, the adjustment was so quick. But so, other difference in Spain, Spain actually had a banking crisis, they were not bailed out, they were not bailed out by the European institutions, just the banking system was supported. Greece had an adjustment program, Spain didn't have an adjustment program. So all these things could help you think about the schemas of institutions, you know, how the far right came to power in Greece, to power, so to prominence in Greece, more so than, let's say, in Portugal, and things like that. Whereas if you, so it seems to me that, you know, looking at the general patterns, then, okay, why don't you go to the big sample and then exploring all the variation in the data, you know? And I think the way it was represented, you know, we didn't hear a lot about the specific choices in the crisis and how the countries were affected. It was just the EPI index, basically. And on the other hand, we didn't see everything about all the variation, what happened in Hungary. Hungary had the banking and mortgage crisis in very early in the crisis, that is 2007. Last year, as I mentioned, and stuff. So, in a way, the framing that you present sits in the middle of the two.
So, comments which you accept over again. Spiro.
Right, so, let me start by saying that this is the kind of project that I love, like seeing presentations for new papers about, because you're a journal editor, you know, political scientists now trying to crack a walnut with a sledgehammer. And, you know, big questions are, I think, way forward in many of the stuff that we should be doing. And I do think that this is a big question. I think it's interesting. I do think, however, that the main dependent variable that you were talking about is not really related to trust at the end of the day. This is just government popularity. So,
just government?
Government popularity. So, it measures government popularity over time, actually, lack of popularity over time. And I think if you collect all the opinion polls that appear every week, every month, that I think I've sent you the last 10 years, the correlation is going to be very, very high between those. You can see that even in 2022, trust in government is at 30%, which is exactly where democracy is supported right now. Right? So it's what I'm trying to say with this is not that you're trying to frame something in a way that I'm not sure is gonna be accepted in the end. And I also saw, and that's the good news, that you have a very nice measure there, trust in political parties. Trust in political parties is a different story, right? It's about all parties, it's about the institution of parties.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. And there, I think that the variation is different, and I also think that the variation is more interesting. And it taps into what you want to destroy with the macro data that you have. I think that the final slide here that you have, the future research, sort of looking at education age, different subgroups, and you want to do individual level analysis, I would encourage you to basically do exactly the same, but aggregate those subgroups. So how do we hold, how much do we hold trust in parliament or the judiciary or parties? And actually, I would advise you to focus on parties. But that would be very interesting to see how different demographics respond to the crisis. I do subscribe to most of the comments that Vasilis made about measurement, and what Kevin said about perceptions and the economic performance thing, which is a bit old. I mean, I thought looking at the series, I thought it was a bit old. This is not how things were.
About what? Which
the economic performance time series that we had during the crisis, yeah. The economy suddenly being amazing after 2015. It's not something that I think.
It's based on data. Right?
I know. I understand. I think
inflation was negative. So
probably. Well.
Yeah, because it goes together for.
I don't know. I'm just thinking whether there would be better ways of doing that. But I think trust is a difficult word, and it's loaded. I mean, there's too many literatures that you might be entering into weird debates with colleagues about whether you're measuring or you're not measuring. My recommendation would be, you know, if you focus on trusting parties, it's a different story. You can make the claim that this is not based on motivated reasoning, so winners and losers, as you had in the literature, and something that really mattered because it's the foundation of you know, most political parties.
Could I just put in parentheses that, Sophia, that I'm going from memory, but I think the Paul Rothstein stuff from Gothenburg is not just trust in an institution, it's trust in an institution to perform in an impartial fashion or some such. That the survey isn't just do you have trust in government or do you have trust in the judiciary. I thought the Bo Rothstein quality of government stuff was trust in the institution to perform in an impartial fashion. But so
yeah, I don't recall the question, but what I know for sure there's no data over time.
Okay,
yeah.
Your barometer is very different, but the Rothstein stuff do some of their own surveys, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
But there's two points.
Essentially, they come up with an aggregate number per country per year.
Okay, but there's two points. There's Spiros's point about whether the dependent variable should be trust in political parties.
Yeah.
And, okay, let's do with that, because the other point is...
Yeah, the point about parties, I think the literature, actually what the literature tends to do is look at all these four different dependent variables and disaggregate them, and essentially you might see that there are different, I'm talking broadly speaking here, mm-hmm. right? There might be different drivers for different types of trust, so objects of trust, this is how they're called. Trust in government could be a proxy of, yes, whether you voted for them or not, absolutely, but there's obviously trust in parliament, which is about the general institution of parliament. My personal view is that this is the most interesting one, because it's about the institution of parliament and includes all the parties that are in there, right? So would you trust the parliament even if a party that you fully disagree with has representation, for instance, right? Because that's the point of trust. The problem with trust in parties, in this specific example, sorry, in specific case election, is that it doesn't vary that much over time. Actually, what you see is about 0.2 until about around about the crisis, and then it kind of gets half to about 0.1. And there is, of course, some fluctuation, and depends at what level you're looking at the data, but the fluctuation and the variation you see more is in government and parliament.
What do you think trust in parliament means?
For the respondents, you mean. It's about the general institution of parliament, right? Do you think that, and of course it might mean different in different countries, right? Because the role of parliament is different in the UK, say. The parliament, because the majoritarian system is the government in a way, right? But in a consensus type of system, the parliament is more consensual.
Yes, but you know, in a survey, if I was asked, do I trust the British Parliament, I wouldn't know how to answer that question. I'm not quite sure what the meaning is. To go back to the EQI stuff from Gothenburg, then I'm sure there's references to impartiality with the institutions rather than simply...
Yeah, impartiality has to do with corruption, right? Whereas impartiality has to do with corruption. So it's about the quality of governance.
Multiple measures of.
Yeah. Whereas if you trust the parliament, in a way, it's whether you trust the input of democracy. It's not about the output. So because if they are corrupt, then of course the output, what will come after, might privilege some individuals or some groups versus others. Whereas whether you trust the institution in itself is whether, you know, despite the fact that you might disagree with a party, are you happy that this party is part of that party? At least this is how I would read it, and I think much of the literature looks at it as independent of corruption, in a way.
And because Kevin also the Paul Rothstein, yes, I never learned it. It is expert survey, so it's not, so I mean, the barometer, it is supposed to be, because, since that it is, representative of
the population.
Yeah.
So it's what people think.
Do you have about 1,000 respondents by waves?
No, it's not. It's also.
I think
it's the people also. Yes. How many times have they been exposed to corruption last year?
Yes. Yes.
How many times have they asked for a bribe in the hospital?
Yes.
Because
you made a boo-boo.
But the data set that I have seen is that essentially the data set that they share, at least the ones I've seen, is that they aggregate that. So if you're going to import that in your data set, it's going to be aggregate level measures, not at least the ones I've seen. And I think they've got 3-4 times in the past, they don't even have every year.
Okay, James.
Yeah.
In regards to this general study, do you think it's worth measuring trust just in elections in general?
Mm.
In the sense that, like, that's a lot of people might, let's say, trust the institution of Parliament, but not the first past the post system, the way like the President or Prime Minister is elected.
Mm.
In the case of like the United States, people might allege widespread fraud that could be tied to private companies, and, you know, but still respect the institution of, like, say, the presidency or the Senate.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good point, and obviously it's becoming more salient and more important, you know, with the recent US elections and so on. In a way, that would go part and parcel of whether you kind of support a democratic regime, but there are no questions on these kinds of things. That these are, you know, they have not been deemed in the past as questions worth asking by cross-national comparative surveys. So, but I think it's a very good point, and especially in the most recent times, right? Because these scandals and all these ideas of fraud, or whether you accept, kind of, if you lose, whether you will accept loss and so on.
Sorry, Kira, I thought you were going to, okay. I think we are out of time then, but thanks very much indeed. I think the idea of focusing on 50 years after the restoration or the inauguration of democracy is a neat idea, a nice peg. And of course, as you alluded to, there's a vast literature in the past about processes of democratization, and perhaps democratization is an encompassing thing about resilience and trust. So it's a natural reference point in addition to that literature. But also, thank you very much for coming at the beginning of the research project and sharing it with us, and helping us to explore stories and themes, etc. So thanks, Sophia, very much indeed.